together to fight for what we love.
Holds a significant amount of privilege and power over other groups.
You're listening to
Consider the Alternative.
Consider the Alternative.
Consider the Alternative.
Consider the Alternative.
A CITR podcast.
Hello, my name is Guilherme Rosales, and I am a student in the Master of Public Policy and Global Affairs program at UBC. Today, I will be conducting an interview with our esteemed guest, the Honorable David Eby, our current Attorney General in British Columbia. Before becoming our Attorney General in British Columbia, he worked at Pivot Legal Society. He was the Executive Director of British Columbia Civil Liberties Society. He was also an Adjunct Professor of Law at UBC for a bit. He has served as President of the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network, and he has also been a Research Associate for the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. Thank you, Mr. Eby, for being here today for this interview.
Thanks for having me.
But to start with, firstly, what made you want to become a lawyer?
Well, I didn't actually want to be a lawyer. My dad was a lawyer, and I saw the work that he did, and I wasn't especially interested in it. And I did first year biology to try to avoid it. It did not stick. And I worked actually as a technical writer for my first couple years in the real world. Done an English undergrad, and I was writing loss prevention and safety programs for big U.S. retailers and Canadian retailers, food safety programs. Mm. Good food, safe food. Maybe you saw my video if you're ever trained at M&M Meats, for example. So it was a pretty random job. But after a while, it lost some of its charm. One of the things I was really involved in my undergrad years was human rights advocacy and environmental rights advocacy around the anti-globalization banner, really, at the time, around these big trade deals that were being struck without any protections for the environment or workers, or grossly inadequate protections. And after I left school, I really missed that. And I had an invitation from a friend to go out to a big demonstration a couple years into my real world career, and I went to this big anti-globalization demonstration in Quebec City, and there were these lawyers doing Know Your Rights training. And I thought, oh, okay, this is something where I can pay the rent, because lawyers obviously are able to pay the rent, right? But also able to do work that I'm interested in around issues that I'm interested in. So I went to law school to try to incorporate those things together in my life. It was a really good decision for me. It worked out super well.
Did you ever see yourself becoming the Attorney General or getting into politics when you started your law career? And why did you choose to pursue politics after law?
I did never imagine that I would be the Attorney General. The reason why I went into law was a frustration around politicians and really how craven they were and cowardly when it came to difficult decisions, and how the courts had to force them to do the right thing again and again. And gay marriage was a big issue in front of the courts at the time. It was just one example of something that was so obvious that should be done and was an equality issue, and yet these politicians couldn't bring themselves to do it. The courts had to force them to do it. And it was quite a journey to go from there to recognizing the power of politics, and that actually there was an appetite even for electing someone with my particular perspectives on what needed to be done in the world, because I grew up in Ontario, and until I moved out west, I never voted for anyone ever who won an election. So, you know, I was consistently voting for progressive candidates that didn't stand a chance. And so coming out here, it was kind of a different experience, but what really got me involved in politics was frustration around, I was working in the downtown east side, I was working on housing issues with people who are underhoused in these residential hotels. And my clients would come and say, look, we got no heat, we got no hot water, we got bugs, we got all these problems. Landlord won't fix it. We go to the residential tenancy branch, get an order, we'd enforce it as a small claims judgment. Then we'd have to start contempt proceedings because the landlords wouldn't show up. It was just a nightmare. And in the course of legal research around these cases and various judicial reviews, and we were pointed to something called, at Pivot Legal Society at the time, pointed to something called the Standards of Maintenance Bylaw. And this meant the city had certain minimum standards of maintenance in residential buildings. And if landlords didn't meet them, then the city would go in, could go in, do repairs in the building and bill them back to the landlords through the property tax system. I thought this was brilliant. I mean, and my clients were incredibly poor. Many of them had addiction issues or mental health issues or other disabilities. It made them really hard to bring their cases forward. And the city could do all this work, and they could do overnight what would take me years and years and years of court cases for my clients to achieve. So I went to City Hall. I was like, hey, guys, great news. You've got this amazing bylaw. You don't use it. You should use it. And they turned around to their staff and said, should we use this? And the staff said, you know, we can't use it like for for this reason, that reason, and used legal tools to overcome all of these jurisdictional objections the staff had. And then finally, at the end of the day, the counselors had to say, we just don't want to do it. It's too much responsibility, too much liability. We just don't want to do it. And I got so frustrated. I was like, forget it. If you won't do it, I'll run for city council and I'll do it as part of a platform. So a very cocky and naive approach to politics, frankly. Ran for nomination with a municipal party called Vision Vancouver. They were just getting started up in Vancouver and lost by 14 votes, 17 votes, something like that. And so it was a really close call, but they Vision incorporated some aspects of the housing platform I was running on as a candidate for nomination into their platform as a municipal party. And then they ultimately started using the standards of maintenance bylaw. And it was such an eye-opener because I spent maybe 2 months on the campaign working really hard, but only about 2 months, and was able to achieve through that what years of advocacy and court cases hadn't been able to achieve. And it might sound strange, but I really realized how powerful politics is as a tool for change, and that actually getting involved can have a change in the outcomes that you see in terms of the activities of cities, provinces, federal government. And also, I learned during the campaign that I was good at it, that this was I had a weird set of skills that came together nicely in politics. And so when you come close in politics once, then people start calling you for other gigs. And I got called to running in 2009, lost again, 2011, lost again, and then won in 2013 for the first time. So it was a bit of a weird road to get to politics, but again, born out of a frustration with politicians.
What are some of the biggest challenges you've faced in your career path overall?
The biggest challenges have really been personally burnout. The realities of the jobs that I've had have often been that if I'm not doing the work for the clients that I've been working with, then no one else will. And it's not that there weren't other people doing that kind of work, but they were also all at capacity and working over capacity. So if I couldn't help someone, then I couldn't refer them to someone else who would do the work. And so just managing that work-life balance and the responsibility that someone comes into your office and says, listen, I need your help. Yeah. If I don't get your help, I'm going to be homeless. And homelessness for me means all kinds of risks, my physical health and safety, and maybe I'll lose my kids. And so taking on all that responsibility for that person, or saying, no, I'm sorry, I can't help you. I'm already working like these crazy days and there's just no space, and turning people away in that kind of desperate situation. For me, it's always been trying to manage that work-life balance and making sure that it makes sense for me, and understanding that I can't solve everyone's problems, and spending my energies focusing at those systemic issues where I can make the biggest impact. That has been the hardest learning for me, and learned through hard experience. And I see lots of people in similar situations, the environmental scene or human rights scene or in politics, just throw themselves into the job with everything they've got, leaving no space for anything else. And the temptation's always there, but it's really hard to, if you want to do this work sustainably, then you really have to pay attention to it.
Definitely. Self-care is extremely important for your mental health and general well-being, and how you can give back to the community.
Yeah.
What has been some of the work you've been most proud of in your career so far that you've done?
A lot of things. I've been really fortunate in working with some amazing people to do some really interesting work. Worked with a whole bunch of really great people on ending police self-investigation in British Columbia. This is where police are involved in cases where they kill somebody or seriously injure somebody, that the police themselves don't investigate themselves. There were a whole group of people, I was part of it, that worked to end that system in BC, and we did successfully end it. The current state of play in the real estate market, where people now broadly accept that we have a problem in our real estate market, that there are issues with money laundering, there's issues with international capital, that it's okay to talk about these things, and that it's appropriate for government to intervene to level the playing field for local buyers and to rein in excesses around regulation and deregulation and so on. Did a lot of work on that with some really good people, and I think that we've had some really good success on that, and I feel quite proud of that. And, you know, I felt incredibly proud to be a part of the team that beat Christy Clark in the 2013 election, and then to defeat the Liberal government in 2017. Because I think when you look across the country right now, and I'll put a partisan hat on, I think that BC, whether it's you're interested in climate issues, environmental issues, or whether you're interested in human rights issues, or whether you're interested in the economy and how we move forward as a progressive province in Canada, I think BC is a leader across Canada. And when you look at what's happening in Ontario right now, what the alternatives are pretty stark. So I feel really proud of what's being done within government right now.
What do you think are some of the biggest policy issues facing British Columbia and Metro Vancouver?
Housing is the biggest issue. You can ask anybody what the biggest issue is in Metro, and odds are good. 9 times out of 10 people will tell you that it's housing. And people have all different perspectives on what the housing issue is, but that's something that really brings people together and nodding their heads. Maybe gas prices right now, but housing. And the housing issue around the excesses in the housing market and the problems that we've had is going to take a bunch of years to fix, but we're making some really good progress on that issue. But I think that that is a profound multi-year, multi-level of government issue that we need to tackle for the future of Metro Vancouver. We know what happens if you don't deal with it. It's become a resort city, and Vancouver's well on its way to becoming a resort city, and we're trying to reverse that process to have it be a real city with its own industries and supporting people who live and work in the community, and that it's a city that's accessible to everyone. So I think, personally, I still think that's the biggest issue as well for me. I mean, not car insurance is probably the biggest issue facing me in the portfolios that I have.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, every dollar that our insurer loses is a dollar that's not available for housing or something else. Mm-hmm. So I feel that very acutely. But province-wide, I think housing is the big issue.
Do you think one way to kind of alleviate some of this problems would be to consider, kind of as we're seeing with a lot of the Democratic nominees and the rhetoric they're saying, whether they'll enact it or not, but to tax the rich a bit more? I mean, we have Elizabeth Warren saying just a little bit. Obviously, AOC saying a lot. I think most people nowadays are realizing a marginal increase would probably be a good thing. And you even have people like Warren Buffett and other billionaires coming out saying we should be taxed more. Yeah. So I guess kind of what's your take on that specifically for BC?
So the finance minister or provincial finance minister has put forward a package of, it really is a tax shift package. There are significant tax reductions for lower and middle income British Columbians, the elimination of the medical services premium, the elimination of interest on student loans, the elimination of tolls on the bridge, the when you put all these things together, it's a really big deal for a lot of middle and lower income and even some middle upper income families. And there's no question that there have been increases in taxes, and they've been particularly focused on certain groups. Those who are at the highest income levels in the province have faced a small income tax increase. People who own homes that are valued at $3 million and more have faced an additional provincial property tax, 0.2% on the first million above three, and 0.4% on each $1 million after that. And then people who are speculating in the housing market or people who are holding property empty are facing a significant tax, a 2% tax on the assessed value of the home. And that includes people who are buying property here but earning income somewhere else to make sure that they're paying for the services that make this a desirable place to live. So there has been a tax shift, and I think it was a necessary one. Previously, the tax cuts that were put in place by the previous administration disproportionately benefited the wealthiest people in British Columbia, and the decision by our government was to turn that on its head and to have tax shift benefit to middle and lower income people in the province. I just want to note that, like, it's not, you know, representing Vancouver Point Grey, which is a wealthier constituency. I think it's the second wealthiest, maybe third wealthiest in the province. Always an easy sell to constituents, but remarkably, there's a lot of support in the constituency for these kinds of steps. But then, of course, there are also a bunch of red signs on people's lawns with my names on them saying what a terrible person I am for increasing their property taxes, even though it was the finance minister. So, I mean, these things are easy to say when you're on the campaign trail, and the reality in your communities and constituencies, when you put them in place, is people can get really angry with you, for sure.
The future of work, because this all kind of interrelates to this. How does BC, Vancouver, Canada, what do we need to start doing in order to prepare for the future of work with, you know, potentially the baby boomer generation exiting the workforce, which is a substantial portion of people working? And then on top of that, you know, the rise of automation and the worry of it continuing to take jobs. I'm a millennial, if you were to classify me as a generation, and I've realized I'm not going to have one career, I'm going to have multiple careers. And this seems to be a new, maybe it's a stark reality for some, but maybe it's a freeing reality for others. So I guess, what do you think we can do to really prepare for this future that, you know, in many science fiction shows and books out there, it's quite dystopian and looks terrifying?
Yeah, I think that there's a real consensus among economists and others who think about this issue that if you want to be successful in as a modern economy, you have to invest heavily in the people who live in your community, and particularly around education. And you can see that reflected in many of our government programs, whether it's on the technical end, science, technology, engineering, and math, seats, and so on, or whether it's on the end of people just getting them into the labor market to maximize their skills with free English as a second language and English as a learning language training. So if you come to British Columbia from somewhere where people people don't speak English every day, and you're learning English, and you have skills. You're, you know, they're engineers and doctors and others, and that whose skills we badly need in our province, who don't have the English skills, the technical skills to succeed in their occupations. To have people access free English language training can really change their lives. Childcare is another good example of making sure that people are able to, if they choose to, participate in the labor market to the full ability. If you look at our government's economic plan, it's all about investing in the people of British Columbia, their skills, giving them the opportunity to participate to the full extent that they want to in the labor market, and supporting them if they want to go into education. And they're really like heartwarming examples, like kids in care and government care going and receiving free tuition. There's now more than 700 children coming out of foster care arrangements and into tuition-free education across the province. It's going to be transformative for their lives. Mm-hmm. And not only will they be able to contribute in a really positive way to the future of the province, but also they won't be living on the street, or they won't be dependent on social programs. They're going to be out there because of education. And so that is really the answer. I agree that a government that ignores where things are going sets their citizens up for a very bleak future, and cuts to education programs, cuts to programs that support people going to school, cuts to programs that invest in the constituents of those governments are, in the short term, may seem to be beneficial, but in the long term, going to be huge costs for those jurisdictions.
It kind of seems like the other side of this, the conservative, the really regressive view of politics that's occurring, seems like it's really instilling a lot of polarization. And in the States, we see extreme polarization like we haven't seen in close to maybe a century or more. How do you think Canadian society could inoculate itself from extreme political polarization like the U.S., or do you think we're already just as polarized?
Well, I think there are a couple of pieces that we benefit from in Canada. One is that, or in British Columbia in particular, that we've instituted new campaign finance reform rules where we have very strict limits on donations from individuals, and you can't donate if you're a company and you can't donate if you're a union. These changes, they might not seem related to what you're talking about, but what drives this massive political hate machine in the United States is corporate money. Yeah. And without that, you really do have to appeal to people in your community to put forward a vision that they're going to support. Otherwise, you aren't going to get donations for your party, and your party's not going to be successful. And reconnecting politics to people is really, really important, and disconnecting it from this, what it was turning into. I mean, we were on the front page of the New York Times as the Wild West of politics, and that was the United States saying, whoa, look at this crazy place, British Columbia, which was an eye-opening moment for a lot of people saying, oh, I didn't realize we were so out of step. But we're totally out of step, even with many U.S. jurisdictions, state-level jurisdictions. And so that provides an opportunity for people to reconnect with actual people in their community to support their run and reconnect folks with that. The benefit of a minority parliament, which we have right now in BC, and it's weird how it's playing out. It's not playing out really how I thought. I sort of thought that the other two parties, the Liberals and the Greens, might get together on more initiatives, but that hasn't been the reality. But I do think that it has forced at least a couple of the parties, namely the Greens and our party, the NDP party, because we're working together in this confidence and supply agreement, to be more collaborative in our approaches. And I think it's been really positive for British Columbians, and it's led to increased transparency, and it's led to a bunch of unexpected benefits. And I'm hopeful, it feels very stable right now, I'll knock on wood, but I'm hopeful we'll go the distance actually as a minority parliament, which is kind of a strange thing too in Canadian history. So maybe we're a bit of a counterexample. Today's the Alberta election. It's been a very polarized discussion in Alberta. So there are definitely exceptions to the rule. You know, I do feel that there are some bright spots here in terms of Canadian discourse versus what's happening in the United States.
It really does seem like it's a good time to remind people to find common ground, especially with your political opposites. And I know that's something that at this school we're definitely trying to keep an open mind to, and always moving forward and thinking about whenever we're talking to people, because otherwise you just risk further polarization.
It was strange for me coming into politics to recognize that even within a uniform political party there was such a diversity of views in BC. I know that sounds strange, but to meet people who were so separated from their colleagues in the same party on key questions of the day was really weird, especially within the BC Liberal Party, that I always saw as a uniform force of bad policy in our province, that there were these islands of people saying, no, I don't think we should do this, or there was dissent within their party. And so there are, like, the problem with polarization is it gives people who are outside of politics too this weird perception that there's just two viewpoints in the province,
yeah,
or in the United States or whatever, or three. And it's really not the case. And it makes people feel like there's not a point for them to participate. I mean, we could list all the problems with it, but the harder question is how to solve it.
One last question. How do you think we can bridge the urban-rural divide that's been occurring for many years? And having been a forest firefighter for the past 5 years, working out of Hope, BC, traveling the province and seeing all these small towns, you know, people are people wherever you go, but there's definitely a difference, and there's definitely this tension seemingly between, you know, an urban center and more rural communities. Mm-hmm. So in my travels, I mean, I think connecting with people, sharing your stories, and really just finding that common ground makes a difference. But on a larger scale, like what can BC, what can the government, what can civil society actors do to help bridge this gap?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's something that I think is an issue certainly in BC. We see it in the Alberta election. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about the American jurisdictions to know really how it's playing out there, although I could guess. There's no question that there's been a playing of urban versus rural for political advantage for a long time. And even when there are good policies put forward by one party or the other, you know, say, oh, this is, you know, city people trying to tell you what to do, or this is like the rural people trying to, you know, do whatever. And so it's not particularly helpful in a province like BC that is such a massive province with such different people all across the province that are dependent on so many different industries and live such different lives because of that and have such different experiences. One of the things that's been most instructive for me, and I candidly admit that, you know, I grew up in a suburb. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't move to Halifax and Toronto and Vancouver, had very limited experience outside of urban centers until I really got involved in politics. And then that opened up a world of travel inside BC and visiting all these communities. And when I was at the Civil Liberties Association, I had very little insight into the realities of rural life. And I'm not sure, but I suspect that the reverse is true for many people living in rural communities. So providing opportunities for people to travel within the province, to see different communities, as you say, to meet with other people and to hear their stories is really the only thing I've seen that's been particularly successful in helping people work together better.
Yeah.
We've had some good successes as government in achieving goals that are shared by city people and rural people around resource management, including Indigenous communities, and the fish farm issue in the Broughton is a really good example of industry, government, First Nations, and community coming together to resolve a really intractable problem around wild salmon and fish farming. And we're hoping to see similar examples of that success in other areas of the province. But that will help to reduce tensions between First Nations and non-First Nations communities, to see that there are shared wins around conservation as well as resource use. And those are very difficult conversations. I'm hopeful that we have enough time to demonstrate success in some of those projects, and that will help break down some of those, unfortunately, you know, very binary perspectives about how we use our resources in the province and what should be done.
All right. Thank you so much for coming here today and allowing me to interview you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thank you once again for listening.